everyone. Welcome. I'm Janet B. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. Great to be back and see all your smiling, happy, welcoming faces. Tonight, we are going to talk about working with others. So that is page 89, chapter 7 of the Big Book. So I'm just going to kind of not go through every single line, but point out some highlights. So just to set the stage, we are at step 12. So this is the point where someone has gone through all the steps. Food obsession is gone. Amends are made. We're praying and meditating. We're seeing our defects, asking God to remove them. And now our sponsors tell us, okay, if you want to keep what you have, you need to go find someone else to help. And, you know, I remember my first sponsee, I didn't know what to do. And her name was Annika. And I remember I gave her an assignment and she was kind of balking. And I called my sponsor and said, what do I do? Like, if I have a sponsee who doesn't, you know, who doesn't really want to do it. And what he said was, you need to teach her. But what I thought my sponsor said was, you need to beat her. So luckily that got clarified and no wooden sticks came out. We are not in the beating people up business. As you'll hear, we don't beat people up for sure physically, and we don't beat them up verbally, mentally, spiritually, anything like that. Melissa and I really believe that the formula to best help someone recover, well, because of course the recovery is always up to them and God, but the best environment that we can offer is two things: love and correct information. So if we know nothing else, those are the two things: love and correct information. So with that, we will start on page 89. Denise, could you read the first paragraph for me, please?
Absolutely. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill.
Thanks. Sometimes when I'm working with someone, the first thing I have them do is read the first sentence out loud. Practical experience shows nothing will so much ensure immunity from, for us, compulsive eating as intensive work with other compulsive eaters. Guys, look at the beautiful promise in there. We can have immunity against compulsive eating, right? There's all this talk now about, you know, getting immunity against COVID by a vaccine. We can have immunity against compulsive eating. That means we're safe and protected. The illness of compulsive eating can't touch us. What do we have to do? Work intensively with other compulsive eaters. Now, of course, you know, on day one, we can't do that. It's a process. We need to go through the steps, starting with one. And each step, starting with step two, we get a little more power, right? Step two, we get our first infusion of power. By the end of step five, it says that the feeling that the drink problem, or for us, the food problem, has disappeared will often come strongly. By the end of step nine, it says that we will seldom be interested in, for us, food not on our food plan. Like, and if tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. And how do we stay that way, where we have no interest in food not on our food plan? Intensive work with other compulsive eaters. It says it works when other activities fail. What other activities? Doing an inventory, praying and meditating. I need to go and help someone. Remember in chapter one, Bill Wilson said that even in recovery, he was sometimes plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. And he said, when all else failed, he would go to the hospital, help another alcoholic, and leave there remarkably set on his feet. It's like we were designed that way, right? Other people, when they have problems, something or whatever may get them better, but it's like we were designed. I don't know if earth people are, but we as addicts certainly are. It's like God made us. When there's trouble, what we do, we go and we, of course, we resolve it. We look at our part. If we've done something wrong, we help someone else, specifically and most important, other compulsive eaters. And then we are immune. And it says, carry this message. I don't get to carry a message I make up. So I'm responsible for really learning this book and this message. And it says, you can help when others fail. Remember, they're very ill, not bad. So if we're sponsoring someone and they pick up, we don't get mad like they've done something wrong. This is an illness. It's an illness. And so until it's treated, you know, until a person does what they need to have God remove it, you know, they may pick up, but they're not bad. We all have an illness. Some of us have just worked the program, so we're a little ahead in the line, but we're all on the same line. So then it gives us more promises. It says, life will take on new meaning. You'll see loneliness vanish. And it says, you'll have a host of friends. You'll see a fellowship grow. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. I have a question. How do they know what I'm going to want when they say, we know you're not going to want to miss it? How do they know? Because they know what happens to our hearts. As we work this program, we get changed. We get changed from being selfish, self-centered, self-absorbed, to really caring about others. And they say, yeah, we know you're going to love this. You're going to love helping others and having a fellowship. And they tell us what the bright spot of our lives is: frequent contact with newcomers and with each other. And then they start giving us some advice. They say, okay, don't start out as an evangelist or a reformer. That's pretty interesting. My job isn't to reform. My job isn't to change someone. My job is to do God's will, right? We all learned that when we did step three. My job is to do the will of God as I understand it. And as I understand it, his will for me as a person who's been graced with recovery is to carry this message for free to someone else. That's it. My hope, my prayer is that they all get better, but I don't sit there and, you know, do tick marks. Oh, I got, you know, X number of people through the steps. And the more I get, the, you know, the bigger my crown with God. No, I'm not an evangelist. I'm not a reformer. And it says, we don't do that. And it says, we can be uniquely helpful to others because of our experience. And it tells us, so cooperate, never criticize. And I think we have to be mindful of that for people who do things, even in Overeaters Anonymous, maybe a different way than we do. So if someone does their fourth step a different way, or if someone says, oh, and you know, where I go to OA meetings, no one's allowed to eat fill in the blank, or people have to do fill in the blank. And we can just say, okay, that's fine. You know, we don't all, there's certain things we don't all have to do. For instance, I tell my sponsees, they have to spend 30 minutes every morning in prayer and meditation with God, because this program's about getting a relationship with God. And how do you get a relationship if you don't spend time with someone? Now, another sponsor may say 10 minutes or may say an hour. 30 minutes isn't a magic number. So again, on things like that, we don't criticize. We just say, yeah, this is what worked for me and this is what I'm passing on. Okay, top of page 90, they tell us what to do when we've discovered a prospect. So this is before we're even sponsoring someone, we've got work to do. And it says, find out all you can about him. So when I, if someone calls me and says, hey, you know, interested in talking to you about sponsoring me, and I don't know them, I want to find out about them. I want to find out kind of, let's see, how long they've been coming to meetings, if they've been coming to meetings, their successes, their failures, their religious leaning. So I don't say something that offends them. I want to know, like, do they believe in God, or are they open to it? You know, what are their beliefs? I found it now helpful to get an idea of, like, a general idea of their age. And I say this because I had a big, a misstep recently. Someone called me and I said, okay, tell me about your eating history. And she was going on and on, like, talking in depth about her eating history in college. Now, I thought she, from the sound of her voice, I thought she was about my age. So I'm thinking, okay, if she's spending, you know, 20 minutes on college, you know, it's going to be about 4 hours before we get to, you know, all right. Well, it turns out she was just like 22 years old. So for her, college was 5 minutes ago. So that's why we need to get an idea, or, you know, is a person married? Do they have kids? If there's a single mom with 8 kids, I may not be asking her to go to a meeting every day. But if there's someone who has, like, she's retired and has no kids and no responsibility, I may say, yeah, I'd like you to go to a meeting a day. So again, while there's some things that everyone needs to do, like for my sponsees, it's 30 minutes of prayer and meditation every morning. We all need to get a relationship with God. We all need to do a 4-step inventory. It's not cookie cutter. So we want to get to know the person. The other reason is that, you know, people don't want to feel like projects. So we want to be friends. And what do you do when you meet someone, like at church, at school, at work? You have some questions about themselves. Oh, yeah, what do you like, you know, what do you do in your spare time? What's your job? Oh, do you like your job? You know, you have kids. Oh, how are your kids doing? Things like that. We, you know, we get a friendship going. We don't just start, someone calls and it's like, okay, read the first 164 pages of the big book. What are you willing to do? We don't do that. We're friends. We're not drill sergeants. Okay. And it says, we want to wait and make sure they're interested in stopping. It says, if he doesn't want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. That's not our job, to persuade someone why they should stop binging. But I'm saying, be careful if he doesn't want to stop drinking. Sometimes people will say, oh, I guess I don't really want to stop. And I'll say, really? Then, like, why are you going to meetings? And it's like, well, I must not want to stop because I'm still binging. So there's a difference between having the desire and having the power. Someone may want to stop, but be unable to. I guarantee 100% of cancer patients want to recover. They just don't have the power generally and need some kind of outside intervention. So we want to make sure they want to. So what I generally say is, if your fairy godmother was going to come here and wave a magic wand and remove the food obsession, would you say yes? And generally they say yes. I think one time someone said no. And that someone, obviously, it's like, okay, you know, enjoy your day, but I'm not the right person for you. But if they want to, well, then we start talking about if they're, this is still on page 90, do they want to quit for good, not just to fit into a smaller size? So, you know, that at my high school reunion, that boy who rejected me when I was 16 is now going to eat his heart out. Do we want to quit? Do they want to quit for good and willing to go to any lengths to get it, to do whatever it will take? If no, then it says, okay, we don't continue on. They say you might place this book where he can see it in the interval. And what I would say is that person is still welcome at meetings, still welcome to call and, you know, chit chat. They still get friendship. They still get fellowship. But if they're not willing to go to any lengths, my understanding of this book is that they're not entitled to a sponsor, because it says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. So on page 91, they caution us not to give false hope. They say it's actually better to call on someone, to talk with someone when they're, you know, right after a binge, when they're in the, when they feel they can't stop, when they feel hopeless. It says he may be more receptive when depressed. We want someone to feel hopeless, not, yeah, I binged yesterday, but today is a new day and I'm fine. Mm-mm. If they're one of us, yes, it's a new day, but things aren't fine. And if they're one of us, they're going to start binging again. And so we want to tell them that. We don't want to give false hope. Imagine just telling a cancer patient, oh, don't worry, your cancer cells will stop multiplying on their own. Just keep going to Cancer Patients Anonymous meetings. No, that would be mean. So it tells us engage in general conversation. So this is what I call the Starbucks meeting, because pre-COVID days, you know, we could meet someone at Starbucks or something, have a cup of coffee and talk, and we tell our stories. And the reason we do it is to whet their appetite, no pun intended, so that they'll ask us, what did you do to get better? We want to tell them enough about us that they hear our story, that they'll say, I want to know what you did. Now, sometimes they may have heard you share at a meeting or speak at a meeting, so they know some of your story, but you still want to take time to develop a rapport. So on page 92, it says, okay, he asks, tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned you were sick, not bad, sick. Remember, this is an illness. It says, tell him how you struggled to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. The mental twist which leads to the first bite of a binge. So for, I'll just give an example of a way to do it. And for those of you who've heard me talk about the broken bridge before, you can go get a cup of coffee and come back in about 3 minutes. The mental twist, because it never starts with the food. It starts before. And there's something in our brain. And on page 24, this is a page we should go over and over until we really know it. It says that, let me read it exactly. And it says that we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink, or for us, the first compulsive bite. They're telling us that we have broken memories. Well, what does that mean? So this is how I understand it. Normally, there's a, one of my sponsees actually is going to get a cup of coffee right now. So generally, there is a bridge between our memory and our conscious mind, right? If I'm about to touch a hot stove, my conscious mind has the data that, oh, touching hot stoves will burn you, will generate a little thought to run across the bridge from my memory to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger, hot stoves will burn you. And then I don't touch that stove. Or for me, something personal to me, I have a severe cat allergy. If I'm near a cat, I'm liable to have an asthma attack. So I never go near cats. But let's say my sponsee Rebecca, who's got two cats, invites me over and I want to go. And I'm about to say, yes, I would love to. I want to go to your house, meet your kids. Well, in my memory are all these data points of cat-induced asthma attacks. So what'll happen is my memory will generate a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind takes about a millisecond. To say, stop, danger. Cats give you asthma attacks. You can't go, right? My memory protects me. So now let's talk about food. And again, my best example is when I was in college, I would binge on these cookies that came in a box of 20. And I would go out and get them and tell myself, I'm just going to have one or two. Well, we all know how that story ended. I would end up eating the box of 20, and sometimes run out and get another box and keep going. So in my memory were all these data points of Janet saying she's going to have one or two, but eating the whole box of 20. So there I go down the street to Duane Reade to buy my box of 20 to only eat one or two. And my memory generates a little thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger. You're not going to be able to eat one or two. You're going to eat all 20 and more. You're going to hate yourself. Don't do it. Except when it comes to food, the bridge is broken and the thought can't get across. It's there in my memory, but it can't make its way across. I can't keep the memory green. I have no defense against the first compulsive bite. How did the bridge get broken? We don't know, and it doesn't matter. How do we fix it? We can't. So that's the way I would explain the mental twist that leads to the first compulsive bite. So I think it's important that everyone have their own broken bridge stories. Feel free to plagiarize and use the broken bridge and substitute your own, you know, binge story over and over. Instead of cats, you want to give an example of how your bridge works. It could be something like, I once got a sunburn, and every time after that, I always remembered to put on sunscreen. Get your story, explain the mental twist so that a person will say, oh yeah, that's why I can't stop. It has nothing to do with willpower. It's a broken memory. And so we want them to understand and say, oh yeah, I do that too. And we want to dwell on the fact that it is hopeless, that once that bridge is broken, it can never be repaired. And it says, continue, or on the bottom of page 92, to speak of alcoholism or compulsive eating as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. I think that's pretty interesting that they say, the conditions of body and mind accompany it. They're accompaniments. They're like side dishes, but they're not the main problem. The main problem is a spiritual one. But we want to talk about all of them, spiritual, body, mind, but remind them, page 58, you don't want to cite pages to them now. You just want to be having a conversation. It says that once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So once someone says, what do I have to do to get better? Page 93 says, tell them exactly what happened to you, which is, if you're recovered, it's how you found God. And it says, stress the spiritual feature freely. Someone once said to Dr. Bob, one of the founders of this program, I don't like the spiritual part of this program. And he said, this whole program is spiritual. So we don't shy away from that. And if someone says, well, you know, I don't know if I believe in God, what we tell them is, you can choose whatever concept of God makes sense to you. Now, a doorknob doesn't make sense. So obviously it has to be something that makes sense. And it says the main thing, so two things a person has to have: willing to believe in a power greater than himself, and that he live by spiritual principles. So even if someone is just starting out, they can start living by basic spiritual principles. And Karen M. put together, she went through the book and, oh, she's on here now. And she put together a list of the spiritual principles in this book. And they are on our website, recoveryjam.com, under other resources. You can look up other principles. And Trisha, if you could put a link, that would be awesome. A friend of mine who was a recovered alcoholic said, when someone goes to AA, no matter what, they can stop lying and they can stop stealing. So those are spiritual principles we can start practicing right away. No lying, no stealing, and then some of the others, starting to think about others. And it talks about two types of people, a person who doesn't believe in God at all. And it says, okay, around that person, you don't want to use theological terms and conceptions that might be confusing. We want to keep it very basic. And it says, but what if they're like really religious? And that was me when I came around. I thought I was so religious. I thought I knew about God. And then someone said to me, if you had such a great relationship with God, why are you still binging? And I couldn't answer. I got nothing. I couldn't say anything. And I realized I was a practical agnostic. I had believed in God, but it's, as it says here, faith alone is insufficient. So imagine if I was diabetic and I believed in insulin. I believed that, yes, insulin helps diabetes. I have faith that insulin could help, but I never injected it into my arm. My diabetes would be out of control. So it says to be vital, to be alive, for our faith to be alive, it must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. What's self-sacrifice? It means I give up something I want to do in order to help someone else. If I'm going in my pool as much as I want or watching TV as much as I want, I'm probably not doing enough self-sacrifice. And constructive action. So again, I could do self-sacrifice that doesn't benefit anybody, but they're talking about that's constructive, that helps another person. And they're very clear, we represent no particular faith or denomination, that these are principles common to most denominations. You know, unselfishness, putting the welfare of others first, no stealing, no lying, no cheating, and all the other things that Karen has listed on her document. And it says, okay, then you want to outline the program of action. So you want to kind of give a quick overview of, you know, I saw I was powerless. I developed a conception of God, looked at my prejudices against God, got rid of them, made a decision to just surrender my life to God, meaning a decision that I was going to do what I think God wants me to and leave the results up to him. And then cleared away the wreckage of my past, inventoried my resentments, my fears, made amends, got a prayer life going, and I'm now looking to be helpful. And it says, it's important for the other person to realize that my attempt to pass it on plays a vital part in my own recovery. And that the person I'm helping is actually helping me more than I'm helping them. Remember, no one likes to feel like they're a project. And I remember one time I was going to this meeting for a long time, and it just seemed like people weren't recovering and they weren't interested in anything I had to say. And I was go week after week carrying the big book message. And I said to my sponsor, like, this is not helpful to me. You know, I'm carrying the message, but nothing. And she said, you keep going. They're keeping you abstinent, because I got to talk. And eventually, it's actually interesting, the meeting turned around and became a big book meeting. So sometimes we just need to persevere in a meeting. But with a person, again, if they're not interested, you know, if they say, you know what, I'm really not willing to go to any lengths, I'm not willing to do it all, then again, we just remain friends. And it says, the person may say why they don't need to do all of this. Whatever reason they give, it's always the same reason. It boils down to five words. I'm different than everyone else. I'm different than everyone else. I'm smarter. I'm not as smart. I'm older. I'm younger. I'm fatter. I'm thinner. I have 5 college degrees. I can barely read. It doesn't matter. We all suffer from this terminal uniqueness. But again, it's the same. And so it says, okay, when we're done, give the person a chance to think it over. And so I know what I generally do, what Melissa generally does is, we give them something to do and see if they come back and do it. If they don't, well, there's the answer there. If they do it and come back and it's done and done properly, and doesn't take like 3 weeks till they get back, then okay, maybe. And that's when we say, okay, if we're going to work together, here's what I require. And again, each sponsor can make up their own requirements. I'll just tell you mine just so you just have an idea of something you might want to use. But again, up to you. I require that my sponsees be on a food plan and it's weighed and measured and sent to me every morning before breakfast. Now, once they're through the steps, again, then they can do what they want with things because by then they have a relationship with God. But I require that, while they're working with me, those are the things they have to do. So food plan, 30 minutes with God every day, every morning, because we're developing a relationship. Imagine dating someone and them not wanting to spend time with you. We'd say like, screw this. This isn't someone I want to go out with. Well, if that's how we are in, relationships and friendships, how much more so when we're trying to develop a relationship with our creator. So 30 minutes, I ask them to make 3 phone calls a day, at least 2 of which have to be to people who are strong in their recovery. And I give them a bunch of numbers. So I think it's important to get involved in the fellowship. And then I tell them how many meetings I want them to go to a week. Again, depending on circumstances. And I think that's it. And then obviously just the assignments, okay, we're going to go through the book and, they have to be willing to like go through the book with me. So generally a person's been around Overeaters Anonymous and they're familiar with the 12 steps. If they're brand new, what this book suggests is that we give them a copy of the book. I mean, now we can get it free online. Anyone could get it free online and have them read the first 164 pages, the text section, and say, okay, this is what this program is. Are you willing to do this all? And that's what was asked of me when I met the person who carried the message to me. And I had been binging at the conference where I met her, and she told me to read the book. And I did. And that the next day she said, are you willing to do everything in it? When I say the book, I mean the text section, the first 164 pages. And I said, yeah, there's this one thing I'm not willing to do. And I told her what it was. And we talked about it. It was an amend I didn't want to make. And she said, she didn't just say, well, goodbye. No, she said, are you willing to believe that by the time you get to step 9, you'll be a different person? And I said, okay, yes, I can do that. So that was the start of the recovery journey for me. And it tells us if the person thinks they can do the job in another way, bottom of page 95, or prefers another approach, we encourage them to follow their conscience. No hard feelings. And it says the person shouldn't be pushed or prodded by us, by their family. And a beautiful line, if he is to find God, the desire must come from within, because that's our solution, finding God. And it tells us, don't be discouraged if they don't respond. Look for someone else. And what's the criteria? Page 96, someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what we offer. desperate and eager. And it says, don't spend too much time on someone who isn't going to recover, who's not willing. If they're willing, we spend all the time they need. If they're not willing, then we really don't owe it to them. And I just want to close with something, and then we'll pick it back up Thursday. Page 95. I think this is a really important paragraph. Denise, can you read the one that starts with if, second full paragraph?
If he is sincerely or if he is not interested?
If he is not interested.
If he is not interested in your solution, if he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. This he may do after he gets hurt some more.
Okay, so let's put this in context because it talks about dropping someone. Here, this is someone who we have not even had our second conversation with. This is someone, it's not someone we're sponsoring who they're going through the steps and they're struggling. This is some, they're talking here about someone you had an initial conversation and he says, yeah, I'm not interested in this solution, but he still wants to call every time he binges or maybe wants a little financial help. And it says, no, no. We're not obligated. Sometimes we do. And again, remember, this was written before Zoom when people were in community. So people took other people into their homes. They helped them get jobs. And sometimes they might have given them some money to help them get back on their feet. So they're saying no. If there's someone who's not interested in your solution, but only wants a place to stay or a banker or for you to come pick him up when he's drunk at a bar and can't drive, but doesn't want to work the 12 steps, it says, no, you don't have to. They are absolutely not talking about someone we're sponsoring and struggling. Okay, because sometimes people struggle and there's a whole different set of instructions for that. So we want to be careful. Above all, correct information, yes, but above even that, love. And on that note, we will end and we will pick up again on Thursday.
Thank you.